Welcome to a Frugal Athlete podcast, where we interview athletes, both current and former, on the prudent financial practices and smart career decisions they are making. In these episodes, we dive into what it means to be a frugal athlete. You might think that frugal just means being cheap, but as you will soon learn, being frugal is more complex than that. Hey, what's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of a Frugal Athlete podcast. Today is a very timely podcast with a very special guest. I've been trying to track him down for quite some time. One of the premier gentlemen in the branding space, in the NIL expertise space, Bill Carter. Bill Carter, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Amobi. Thanks so much for having me on. And don't let your listeners believe that I was somehow dodging you. That was not happening. No. We were working out dates. I was not avoiding this.
Let's set the record straight. You were not avoiding this. We're both very busy trying to make impact in the space that we're both in. So for people that may not know you, would love to have a quick bio about your...
Yeah. So I guess I'll start in sort of reverse chronological order and keep it short. So my name is Bill Carter. 3 years ago, I kicked off a new consulting practice called Student Athlete Insights. And I do NIL consulting and NIL education, mainly for brands that are entering the space, but also for sports organizations, universities, and high school athletic associations. Prior to that, I owned and operated a sports marketing agency called Fuse from about the mid-1990s till the end of 2019, when I sold my interest in the business to one of my partners, who is still a very good friend of mine and somebody I talk to every couple of weeks. During my time at Fuse, my focus was really on athlete branding. I represented mainly Fortune 500 brands in their connectivity to professional athletes, mainly across stick and ball sports and all sorts of action sports and other endeavors.
No, I love that. Real quick, because on our show, we get a lot of athlete managers that are seeking the brand deals. Description, you were working on the brand side. So right. When it comes to the brand side, what are you looking for in an athlete? What qualifies us as a brand finding the correct athlete to fit specific brand that you are looking to promote and engage with?
Well, it's interesting. Many of the Fortune 500 major sports sponsors in the country. So the sponsors of the four big professional leagues, tennis, golf, soccer, across the board. Many of those sponsors have whole sports brand groups internally. Mm-hmm. And you would think that one of the primary responsibilities of those groups would be to seek out the athletes that they want to work with. The thing I would remind anybody who's representing athletes, both as an agent, as a marketing representative, is that while that may be the case, you can really give your athlete that you represent a tremendous advantage by reaching out to those sponsors. In other words, being proactive from the athlete side can absolutely still pay dividends, even with major sports sponsors who have a whole team of people to seek out athletes and properties and media deals. They're still open to, you know, making that contact from an athlete or from an agent or a marketing rep and beginning the conversation. So that didn't totally answer your question, but that's something I just wanted to sort of mention to you.
No, I love that. I think it's because I feel like there's a lot of untapped money that people fail to recognize because they think, oh, they have their sports, the Fortune 500, they're only going to go for like the LeBron James of the worlds. But that's not the case. And if you're proactive about it, there's ways, as you mentioned, to figure out ways to, you know, benefit the athlete.
Yeah. And to build on that, Amobi, for 1 second. So one of the brands that I worked on for over 20 years was Mountain Dew. So my agency, along with some others, was the agency that developed the Do the Do campaign in the late 1990s. We were the first to sponsor the X Games. We really navigated that brand to go all in on action sports, specifically skate, surf, BMX biking, freestyle motocross, and some other.
I told you we had a special guest today.
So, but I want to build on the point that you made. So over those 20 years, almost like right out of the gate, and then consistently for 20 years, Mountain Dew spent money at all levels of the sports that they were involved in, right? So they spent at the very grassroots level in snowboarding and skateboarding. They sponsored what I would consider sort of mid-level events that almost sort of straddled the fence between amateur and pro. And then they sponsored X Games and what was once called the Vans Triple Crown and the Gravity Games, you know, media properties that even a casual fan might see on television. And then in the midst of all that, they were also sponsoring athletes, but they were sponsoring amateur, and I'm just using skateboarding as an example. Yeah. They were sponsoring amateur skaters all through those decades at the same time that they were sponsoring household name pros in that community. And so I mentioned that to you because it's like just an example of what you're talking about. Like, unless you're an athlete or, you know, an agent or representing a property, unless you had done outreach to the Mountain Dew brand group and the Pepsi sports team, like, you were never going to get your hat in the ring. You were never going to get looked at. Mm-hmm. Because the people and the agencies who were doing that work, like, we were busy, you know, negotiating the deals and executing whatever the work was. Like, we didn't, you know, we couldn't spend a tremendous amount of time finding the next athlete to sponsor, finding the next property to sponsor. There was some of that, but there's still a lot to be said for the legwork that goes into reaching out to the brand and how effective it can be.
No, that's amazing. I appreciate you sharing that and the transparency around that. And it leads me to my next couple of questions. One, say, because not everyone could be an athlete, but there's a way to be involved in sports, whether it's, like you said, as an entrepreneur doing brand deals on the brand side or the athlete side. Say I'm an athlete manager reaching out to you for the Do the Do campaign. Is it better I come with a pitch already? Campaign locked and loaded. This is what we would think, what makes sense, profile, all that, or just trying to find what value I could bring based on your needs as a company, as a brand.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And I wonder if you have the same experience as I do. I'll back up a little bit. You know, there's this notion, I think, among salespeople, this almost sort of like new approach to sales, that salespeople love to ask a ton of questions. In other words, they take the approach that you were sort of referencing in that the second part of your comment, which is they try to want to come to you as a blank slate, mm-hmm. ask you a bunch of questions about what your needs are, then they're gonna, you know, go away and build that solution. Then they're going to come back to you with a solution, right? Yeah. And I think that sounds good in theory, but I don't think it actually works all that well. And you and I probably have these experiences where somebody tries to sell us something, right? It could be anything, not even sports related. Somebody's trying to sell you a new cell phone plan or, an extension on your car warranty, whatever it is. They call you and they just start asking you questions, right? And I have no patience for that. And I suspect, and I'm just a focus group of one, which is always dangerous, but I suspect like I'm not the only one. Like when I hear that, like bells ring in my head, I'm like, I don't want any part of this. Yeah. Like if this person doesn't know my situation enough to bring me at least like the skeleton of a solution, I don't have time for that. Like, I mean, this is not my priority, but if they come to me, and this I think was the first thing you were referencing, is like, if they come to me with like at least the skeleton, like the, of a plan. They know what probably some of my challenges are. And they, in this case, the thing we're talking about, they have an athlete that they truly believe could be an ambassador and a voice for my brand because of who he or she can speak to effectively, then I think that's a good starting point. But I think this entirely like consultative sales approach where somebody comes in and asks you like a million questions, like, man, I got to move on from that. I don't have time for that.
Yeah, I feel you on that. No, that's really great advice. I appreciate you sharing that because there is a new way of, it's just too many meetings. Like let's get to the bulk of the meat and the bones of what we need to talk about. Obviously in a respectful way, but I think it's really important. Before we, I have another question for people that are looking to get in the space on the, you know, brand development, brand partnerships. You started a business, very successful, exited, started a new business. Any advice for anyone looking to get in the sports business space as an entrepreneur? Is it, you know, work in corporation, learn a little bit, go on your own, or sometimes you got to roll with the punches, go straight on your own? Like, what advice would you have if you were to do it all over again?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm going to date myself a little bit by saying this, by saying that I think the world has changed a lot in it's been almost, so I'm 54. We started the agency with the two business partners and I, when I was 27. So, you know, 27 years, like that's a lot of ground. I would say 27 years ago, I was really naive, but I think we lived in a world where you could be more naive and still probably be pretty successful. This was also like, I know this is really going to date me. Like this is also like, you know, right around the time where the internet became something that everybody had. Like it was not yet, you know, a lot of people had access, but it wasn't quite the tool that it is today, right? And so I think that's changed a lot of like the behavior. I think the negative that I'd say like a real negative that I see, not that I want to immediately transition to NIL, but I see it in the NIL space, is that there are a lot of entrepreneurs, and I want to be careful. I am very pro entrepreneur. I teach a class called Sports Entrepreneurship at the University of Vermont. Like I am all in on entrepreneurs, but there are a lot of entrepreneurs in the NIL space that are naive about not their product or service and not what it can do, but they're naive about so many other facets of the sports industry that they talk about and position their product or service as being this end-all, be-all solution, not recognizing that for the last 20 years, this other group of entities has been doing the exact same thing, but maybe with a different leaning. You know, maybe the NIL folks are doing it with a piece of technology. Well, that's awesome. But these people over here, they've been doing it sort of maybe in an agency format or whatever it is. I'm being very vague, but you get my point. And so I think I'm really pro entrepreneur, but I love it when I meet an entrepreneur that I can tell that she or he has really done their homework and they can talk about their innovation, but put it in the context of the sports industry. And like, I know they really know what they're talking about, like, cause they get the whole picture.
I love the segue into, you know, your teaching, you know, the athlete entrepreneur, obviously you teach a sports entrepreneurship class, but the athlete entrepreneur is the new wave, whether it's athlete content creator, athlete investor, athlete brand ambassador, athlete entrepreneur encompasses all that. What are the four principles that you think every athlete entrepreneur needs?
Oh gosh. Okay. Well, I'm gonna cheat a little bit. If you see me looking off to my left, I'm cheating because I think about this a lot. I jot down notes a lot. I think there's four sort of like big areas, and I'll promise not to go super deep into any unless you want me to.
That's up to you.
So I think the first one is the personal brand development, like understanding that right now as an athlete, you have a brand. You absolutely have a brand, whether you have paid attention to it or not. You have one. All you need to do is Google yourself, and you will see what others see and what is the raw material that they've used to determine what your brand is. That's the first thing. And then number two around personal brand development is, okay, so then what is it going to take for you to evolve your brand to speak effectively to the audiences that you want to reach, whether it's for yourself or on behalf of a partner that's a paid sponsorship or something. Yeah. Those are the first two things. And then I think, you know, anytime that I think about brand development, I also think about, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, you know, where the rubber meets the road, like do you have to become absolutely proficient? Well, maybe pretty close, but you need to become pretty, you know, fairly proficient in Instagram and TikTok and even LinkedIn. And you probably need your a personal website. And I know that sounds like a little bit crazy in the era of social media, but there's lots of reasons why you want a personal website, because you control that, you own that, right? You don't own social channels. So I think that's my first thing. I think that number two is around professional development, which is understanding time management. I think for college athletes, that means especially in and out of season, one for me, understanding your market value. And then the third one, and I'll stop after this in this section, is I think that athletes really need to understand what it takes to research and prepare to meet with a brand partner, as in a prospect.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you know, athletes are unique human beings, right? Like they've worked very hard, but they, you know, 98% of the time, they also have a special set of skills that are sort of God-given that others, even with a lot of hard work, were never going to be able to achieve. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like that can be a disadvantage to athletes in terms of like understanding preparation in the career setting, right? Like, because you're so used to success as an athlete, I'm not going to say you're winging it, but you're used to success. And in this career development, when you begin to meet with prospects and potential brand partners, I think it's really critical to know what that meeting might look like and know the preparation that might have to go into it. And then, you know, I think number four for me is, you know, your specialty just around all things financial literacy. So I'm not going to go deep into that, just to say that, like, that's obviously something that is, you know, critical to long-term success.
No, I think that's great. I think those four pillars that you stated, They build the table. They hold the table up of what an athlete entrepreneur's brand is going to be, whether it's while they're playing or long after they're playing. So appreciate you sharing. And I definitely would have signed up for this class if I was at Vermont, you know, back in my day.
Do you have any eligibility left?
If I switch sports, I have some years left.
By the way, UVM soccer team made it to the Elite Eight. I mean, they had a good year, but I'm sure they'd like to have you over there for a semester.
We'll see. We'll make it happen. I think this is a great segue to NIL. Obviously, you said you started in 2020. Perfect timing. You just came off the exit of your company. What was it that gave you the spark or the aha moment to step into the space? I imagine you were already doing some consulting, already doing some, you know, branding in that space already, but going all in, that's a risk. And did you see something, or was it a new fire in your belly? Like, what was NIL? Why did it entice you?
Well, so in some ways, and I don't talk about this with many people, but so in some ways, this is sort of coming full circle for me, because I thought I was going to be a college coach. And I played college lacrosse. I played for an unbelievable coach, and a guy by the name of Hank Janczyk, who's the second leading in terms of wins in the history of college lacrosse. He's a phenomenal mentor for me. And so when I graduated, I went to a Division III school, sort of top 10 Division III program called Gettysburg College. Mm-hmm. And when I left there, I took an assistant coaching position and went to grad school at Michigan State. Michigan State at the time was one of the few Division I programs west of the Mississippi. Been a lot of changes since then, but for three seasons I coached there and I loved it, but it taught me that I didn't want to be a college coach. Yeah. I didn't want that to be how I made a living. And so I got out of that and I moved to New York and I began a career in sports marketing. But I've always had a great appreciation for coaches. I've had a great love of college sports. And, you know, a lot of people say that it's like when you and I, you know, meet somebody for the first time and maybe college sports comes up, like, you know, when somebody says that, you know what they mean. They mean they love college basketball. They love college football. And their view of college sports is really about, about 30 schools and about maybe, you know, what is that, 20,000 student athletes at Power Five schools, maybe in total, right? 25,000-30,000. But like when I say I love college sports, I love college sports at all levels. Like I love Division I, II, and III. They bring very unique, distinct things to the table. But I love watching college sports. If I ever like stumble upon it, that like are not sports that I care all that much about, like I'll watch college volleyball. I'll watch college field hockey. Like I love that stuff. And I think what a lot of people don't realize, but you do, because you lived it at a very high level, but you've maintained a focus on a lot of things college sports related, but like the intensity that you would see at a Division III swim meet is no different than the intensity that you'll watch, who did Michigan State just beat on Sunday?
Oh, good game, by the way.
Why am I blanking on that? Great game. Yeah. So like the intensity of like getting into a Sweet 16 game at Division I basketball March Madness is like no different than like any other intensity that you would see across all of college sports. I really love that. And so when it was fairly obvious, I think, to most of us that NIL was going to become a reality, and I wanted to be doing something in the space before the NCAA legislation, which is why I started in 2020 and I didn't wait till 2021. Because I felt like that was going to be too late. And there was a lot that I could do, particularly in the area of gathering data and doing my own surveys of student athletes, which is something that I rely a lot on. So my passion was really in that direction. And then I also think, you know, I'm a proponent, you know, speaking of entrepreneurs and others, like I'm a proponent of like, yeah, you should follow your passion. Absolutely. You should also find places where your passion meets up with things that you're good at and that you have experience in. You know, you and I are passionate about a lot of things that are not careers, right? Yeah. So it's not only about following our passion. I felt like I had the right skill set to follow into and build an NIL consulting practice because of what I had spent 20 years doing.
No, I love that. And I think it's a great to see the appreciation for sports across sports, but also across divisions. And something I just want to make note of, the D3 athletes is just as intense, and their stories, you know, most of them, they don't get athletic scholarships. So they're working on top of school on top of competing. Some of them still have the dream of going to play on professionally, whether it's overseas or lower level, different things. And then when you talk about lacrosse being a niche sport, one of the best examples of an athlete entrepreneur that I first came across when I started a Fruitful Athlete is Paul Rabel. So the possibilities are endless. And I think it's really important that you highlight that for the niche athlete. How can they still win in NIL?
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a great question. And by the way, we could have Paul on this podcast and we could spend an hour him as a case study.
Yeah.
In pre NIL, essentially, Paul was building an NIL business. Post college, right? But some of the things that I'll mention to you about like the niche athlete and where it connects with NIL. So I'll start with this, which is, for some of your audience, not maybe all of your audience, who is very much, in the business and cares a lot about sports and paying attention to college sports. But the one thing we have to remind people is that NIL does not equal brand endorsements, or I'll say it another way. NIL is not defined exclusively by brand endorsements. In other words, the things that look like what we see in pro sports. Yeah. That's not what NIL is. NIL is the right of publicity. And with that right of publicity, an athlete at any level now can generate income, be compensated for the use of their name, image, and likeness. And so what does that mean, like in terms of the activities? It's not just then endorsements, it's camps, clinics, private instruction, social media influencer work, developing your own brand. And I don't mean that in the sense of a personal brand. I mean a literal brand, a sweatshirt brand, a clothing brand, some sort of merchandise, whatever it is. And so it's particularly important for the niche athlete to know about this part of the conversation we're having, because if you're even a, I'll keep going back to lacrosse a little bit. If you're a big time Division I lacrosse player and you play at Virginia, Maryland, Duke, Carolina, those schools, you're still going to have to piece together as an entrepreneur, piece together your NIL business. There's not a, and this is not 100% true, but it's mostly true. There's not a collective who's going to come drop $50,000 in your lap because you're the best midfielder at the University of Virginia. That's not going to happen, right? But if you're the best midfielder at the University of Virginia, you can absolutely run clinics, camps, do private instruction, develop your own brand. You can certainly do social media influencer work, both for lacrosse brands who are always trying to mine the next level of youth players and absolutely will use college players, as well as, using this example, local brands and businesses in Charlottesville or throughout Virginia or throughout the lacrosse community. So the more niche that athlete is, or more niche the sport is, the more important it is for that athlete to see themselves as an entrepreneur and put together what that business looks like. Because no one's going to go drop, no one brand is going to make you an NIL success if you're a lacrosse player or field hockey. But you can absolutely have NIL success.
You hit the nail on the head. And something I tell a lot of student athletes is, you can't worry about being a national star before. You got to be the mayor first. Be the mayor of your local region. From there, be the governor. Then move on to, president. But if you're not the mayor first, it doesn't make sense. So I really appreciate you sharing that, because a lot of times people are discouraged. It's like, oh, I'm not an FBS Power 5 quarterback. I'm not, in the Final Four, but there is a clear pathway, whether it's, I'm doing reviews on all the lacrosse products we get, and I'm going to have an Amazon affiliate link. Or, you know what? I'm going to go back to my local youth club and do a camp because a lot of parents want to know what it takes to go pro.
Right.
You have the ability to do that now with NIL. And if you're smart about it, and if you take, you know, Professor Bill Carter's class, you might find a way to take advantage of it.
And you know, you're making me think too, and you probably have such a great line of sight on this in terms of soccer. I'd love to hear if you have a soccer example, but it can come from another sport. You know, the athlete who says to you, and I hear this too, the athlete who says, well, I'm not a Power Five quarterback, I'm not a Power Five starting point guard, things like that. Like, wait, do you not have a rabid community of fans around your sport? I mean, think about a sport like that you and I don't think either one of us has a connection to, volleyball. My God, volleyball fans are crazy. Like, they love volleyball. Yeah. High school volleyball, college volleyball, but like, you know, in soccer or other sports, like, don't you see that where an athlete can just focus on, as you say, be the mayor, focus on their own community. They can have success just there.
Unbelievably. Yeah, you're exactly right. So I'll just take soccer, for example. And I love this breakdown. It's something as simple as, all right, how I avoid injury. And you can create, soccer's expensive. It's a pay-to-play sport. So it's like, I can create a course. These are 100 drills you should do without having to pay a trainer. Make it for $10. You go to your old local youth club that you played for growing up. You go to your local high school. You go to your community. You go to your, you know, college campus. Sell that. And instead of having to train kids in your off time and homework and school and social life and season, having a digital product, now that you're allowed to have something like that, it could be the difference between, you know, paying for your car. You know, we're not saying it's going to take care of, you know, mom and dad and buy them a house, but these are things to put money in your pocket or things to create skills that are going to help you in your corporate space. That's what I see as the benefit of NIL.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And by the way, I love your examples because that example is a very real example. Create a digital product, use tools to get it out there so it's working for you when you're off doing the things that you're committed to, which going to class, going to practice, going to training room, getting enough sleep. But and the other thing, Amobi, that I love about what you just said is like, but also have, you know, approach this in a real way. Are you going to make $30,000 doing this over the next year? No, you're not.
Yeah.
But you can make an amount of money that will be helpful to the place that you are in your life right now.
Exactly. And I know you can relate. There's so many intangibles that you learn, you know, doing NIL, if you're doing it the right way. Negotiation with brands, building something from the ground up, execution, marketing. So these are things that I'm sure you teach in your class that you will innately get. So you might not see the immediate benefit of monetarily, you know, NIL million-dollar deals, but when sports is over and it's going to be over, whether it's a 10, 20-year professional career or just your college career, that you can take and apply to anything that you do in life. And that's something that I always try to promote. So with that being said, you do a lot of the education side. What are some of the things that if you had a magic wand, you would fix? And not to say anything's wrong with NIL. We don't want anyone to come on the show and say, hey, he's calling out these people. But like, what are some things that could be highlighted or focused on as it pertains to NIL?
Well, so I think I'll start relatively small. And I'll give you just one example. And it's going to sound a little self-serving. So I'll say up front that I wouldn't even care if I didn't make a dime over what I'm about to say. Like, I think that NIL education, both at the high school level and at the college level, should be 100% accessible. And I'll go one step further. It should be required. So I'll give you an example. I'll go a little deeper on this. So right now, there are about half the states in the country in Washington, D.C. permit NIL at the high school level. So high school athletes can use their name, image, likeness to generate income, and about half do not. about half the states prohibit it. And that'll change over the next 2 years. We'll probably be at all 51 jurisdictions, the 50 states in DC, we'll end up permitting it. But to me, it's not about just permitting NIL to happen at the high school level. It ought to be taught at some level, the basics, NIL deal literacy, a little bit of financial literacy, again, age appropriate, the career development piece, just the basics of navigating NIL to be either simply just safe about it or to be effective if it's really something that you want to lean into. Okay. So I think that every, you know, all 8 million high school athletes in this country should have access to NIL education. Now, what's the way to do that? I mean, there's only one way to do that at scale, really, right? Which is, you know, on demand, you know, access to video and other sort of teaching content. I do that. There are a bunch of other people that do that. There are firms that do that. And that's why I say, like, I don't care where it comes from, but I hope that we're in a place 3 to 5 years where 8 million high school athletes have access to that. And I hope the states that permit it, Amobi, the states that permit NIL, I hope they require students.
As almost like as an elective, almost.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, students shouldn't be paying for this, of course, right? It should be paid for by high school athletic associations mainly. But I think the students who participate in NIL in those states ought to be required to have some level of NIL literacy. So that's, I would say, the big one in terms of where I'd see the change coming or where I'd like to see the change. And then I guess the other one is going to be a lot more controversial, which is, and it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen maybe in 3 years, but I think it'll happen probably in about five, roughly, is that if we know where things are headed with college sports, in which I'll give you one example. Like, we knew we were going to end up here. We knew this. We knew it a long time ago, but we didn't really prepare for it. And then all of a sudden it happened. We're like, oh my gosh, the sky's falling.
Yeah.
We can't just simply prepared over the last 5 or 10 years. We could have had a much smoother on-ramp to NIL. We wouldn't be in this sort of somewhat chaotic place as we are now. So now let's think about the next 5 years. Where are we likely to be? Well, I think we're likely to be where Division I athletes, and there may be a separate class of just football and basketball, basketball men and women, and then football. They may be a separate class, but they're likely to be in the revenue sharing business, right? With their schools and their conferences and the TV networks. I hope that filters down to all of college athletics or all of Division I at least, but we're likely to be there. We're likely to be at a place where the institutions are offering payment to athletes in addition to the cost of the scholarship, cost of attending. And so if we know these things, again, like, let's go back 10 years, we knew we were going to be here, but we were still unprepared. We are very likely to going to be in those two places, say 5 years from now. So why don't we, whether, you know, no matter who likes it, no matter who doesn't like it, why don't we begin to solve for that now that when it happens, it's not going to be because the Supreme Court made it happen. Yeah. It's going to be because people made some compromises and we all got there together.
No, I think that's good. I like how you're staying ahead of the game. And I think a lot of times, both on the agency side, the athlete side, the family side, the brand side, we're in the now, and it's important to be where your feet are, be in the present. But when it comes to stuff like this, you got to see where the puck is going in order to, you know, be successful and take advantage and stay protected as well. So you do a lot of the education. You're a great follow on LinkedIn with, you know, continual updates. What are some of the questions you get, you know, from the brands looking to work with the athletes, the families, you know, the people that you serve? What are some of these, I guess, frequently asked questions that you're getting?
Well, I'd say the first one's like a really easy one. I mean, maybe not an easy answer, but an easy question, which is a brand will just say, okay, well, I've been following NIL in the news. It feels like something that my brand ought to be involved in. Where do I start? Like literally, what is step one, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I do is try to help them. And I actually just posted about it this week, like try to get them to sort of see the big picture. And I break it down into these seven steps, which I won't bore everybody with now, but if they want to check it out on my LinkedIn, it's there, which is, you know, starting with like determining what are going to be the NIL activations? What do you want student athletes to do for your brand? Is it post on social? Is it to do meet and greets at a retail store that you have? Is it going to be, what is it going to look like? Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's easier to determine things like, here's how much I'll compensate athletes. Because if I'm going to ask them to do this and I expect certain results, like this would be how much I would pay for that. And then you can get to things like identifying the profile of an athlete who might be a great ambassador for your brand. And then going the next step, finding athletes that fit that profile, training those athletes to be the voice of your brand, monitoring and helping them through the process on a month-to-month basis. And then, of course, measuring how successful this all was. So the number one question I get is, where do I start? And to me, you sort of start with that kind of process.
Okay. I know we spoke offline in terms of marketplaces. It could get a bit overwhelming for a student athlete. There's so many out there, and some good, some not so good, some, you know, provide different qualities. We're not going to get into that, but what's your view on like marketplaces and how it can help or hurt an athlete?
Well, so I guess I'm going to tweak your question just a little bit from the start, which is, so because, you know, the main questions I'm getting are from brands, and they'll say, you know, should I approach this with my agency or with you or with, you know, somebody who's going to, or my own internal team to identify athletes I want to work with, or should we use, you know, one of these digital marketplaces? And just to be clear, who we're talking about digital marketplaces like Mogul, Market Price, Open Doors, Influencer, NBC Sports Athlete Direct, and
you know, Icon Source, Open Sponsorship. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what I like to explain is that those marketplaces have filled an important they're providing an important service in helping with athlete selection and communicating with athletes what your offer is. But they're a tool. I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that, you know, I look at this as sort of like the seven-step process for a brand. And that step where you are engaging with athletes and determining who you want to work with, you can go through a marketplace, and that's one way to do it. You can also work with an agency or a consultant to help you identify specific regions or campuses and then specific athletes, mm-hmm. to bring sort of a more human touch to it in terms of how to go about that. So I think the marketplaces are an important component of NIL, but there are a lot of components to NIL, right? Yeah. And so, and they all sort of work together. I say to brands, you know, you don't have to go through a marketplace. They're probably not the right tool for everybody, but in some instances, they're a really effective tool.
So, and then from the athlete side, how do I price myself? How do I charge maybe more than I might expect? How do I negotiate? What does that look like?
All right. Well, so I think they should start by asking you, because I feel like you probably have a good, really good perspective on this too. So what I would say is this, first of all, throw out the window as an athlete, throw out the window anything you think you know about what other athletes are making, because what you're reading is probably not accurate. And I know this is going to come as a big surprise, but sometimes athletes don't tell other athletes the truth about what their sponsors pay them. Because nobody wants to look like the lowest paid guy in the locker room, right?
That's facts. Yep.
So I think the way to approach it is sort of like the way you approach like even a brand or a business or any entrepreneur approaches pricing generally, which is, yeah, go out there, read what you can, get some idea, use, and then maybe add 25% to that number. Try to use that. And if you don't think that you're selling, in this case, yourself as much as you should be, then you can always drop that price by 10% and eventually drop it another 10% and so forth until you find the right number. So I think it's a pricing strategy. It's and process. It's not, you're never gonna just land on the right number because you read in, you know, some data set that, you know, that Division II basketball players make X on social media. I mean, you can try that, but I think it's really, you're going to have to get in there and test and fail a little bit to arrive at the right number.
And I think NIL as a whole, as a student athlete, you're going to have to test and fail and try things and learn and really be curious about how you go about it. But as we close, I feel like I definitely think we need a part two sometime. Amazing conversation. I really appreciate you. We're going to have all your information in the show notes and description. I highly recommend, if you're listening to this, I have a notebook. I'm writing notes down right now. If you're watching the video, I'm writing my notes. Lots of gems. Bill, in closing, anything that you would want to say, student athlete, anyone in the NIL space, what are some words of encouragement as we move forward, as NIL continues to evolve?
So I guess, you know, I had a conversation. I'll give a couple of guys a plug on something I was writing earlier this week. I had an incredible conversation with two NIL lawyers that are pretty well known in the space, Mitt Winter and Darren Heitner. And you'll see those names quite a bit on LinkedIn and other places as well. And the three of us did this conversation, which I then wrote about, and it's coming out in a column that I write for Sports Business Journal called NIL Corner. It's going to come out in the next couple of days. And it's about sort of the legal atmosphere around NIL. And, you know, one of the things that Mitt said one time and Darren agreed, and then we got to talking about it and it really began to make sense is, you know, it's really not as chaotic out there as maybe people believe it is. In other words, you know, Mitt said, and I don't want to give him the credit if it was Darren first, but I think it was Mitt. He said, you know, right of publicity laws that have been around for 100 years, they've worked for everybody for 100 years. And just because, and I'm paraphrasing now the group, when I say that just because there's this new thing called NIL doesn't mean that right of publicity laws are in chaos. They're not. They were working before for all of us regular people and celebrities and people in the public eye. And they're going to work just fine for student athletes doing NIL deals. And I think I use that, Amobi, just as like one example is like, we get all riled up about like every single part of NIL, whether it's collectives or, you know, institutional policy or what the NCAA is doing, it's all going to be okay. It really is. All of these entities were working pretty well before NIL, and this is all going to get sorted out. And it's not nearly as chaotic as maybe we feel like it is on a day-to-day basis.
No, I love that. I think that's a great way to close. At the end of the day, it's going to be okay. Take it with a grain of salt. Learn from the past. Learn from examples, different case studies. And I really want to appreciate you for taking the time, Bill. It really means a lot. I'm excited to, you know, post this and share with the community.
Thanks very much for having me. It was great to talk to you. I love so many great parts of this conversation, and I'm certainly going to circulate this conversation when it goes live. I really appreciate being on the podcast.
Most definitely. I'm definitely going to have your information in the show notes, but a quick plug for people that if they want to follow you.
So yeah, well, first of all, you can check out my website, which is studentathleteinsights.com. There's a blog there with a ton of NIL data and some other information. You can find me on LinkedIn. Again, my name is Bill Carter. If you just maybe search Bill Carter NIL, you'll find me there. And on LinkedIn, I post an NIL newsletter called NIL Insider every week. And I try to make that as useful, valuable, full of data as possible. So sign up for that newsletter.
Yeah, make sure you sign up. Valuable information. Once again, Bill, thank you so much. Definitely some gems. So make sure you tune in. If you have to replay it, write some notes down. If you would be so kind, leave a review, rate. It helps us continue to find ways to get people like Bill on the platform. And if you're on YouTube, make sure you hit that subscribe button. We're trying to grow. We're trying to create some more impact. So once again, Bill, thank you so much. And we'll catch you at a later time.
Thank you for tuning in to this podcast episode. For more information, check out the show notes and go to our website, www.afrugalathlete.com. If you enjoyed, please leave a favorable rating and review and share and subscribe. Thank you so much.